Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and this morning I'm joined in the studio by Jeffrey Diamond, the CEO and co-president of Goodman Decorating Company. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. How are you?
I'm great this morning.
Fantastic. Tell me about Goodman. It has such a rich history for the city of Atlanta and the region, but tell us about your firm and what you guys are up to.
Well, Goodman is a company that's been in business for 87 years. My grandfather started the business in 1927. He basically walked up and down Peachtree Street, downtown, where most of the business was at the time.
Right.
And became sort of the mayor of Peachtree. That's who people called him at the time, because he was just so omnipresent and was available, and that's why he got work.
Wow.
My father came in the business around 1952, and his name was Leonard Diamond. Grandfather's name was Harry Goodman. My father, Leonard, was an iconic member of the community. He attended Boys High, knew a lot of old Atlanta, and basically built the company into sort of the business it is today in terms of its prestige. I came in the business in 81, 82. My brother, my partner, Richard Diamond, came in 85. And we've been doing painting and wall covering, like I said, for 87 years. We've branched out into fabric panels, special finishes, a number of different types of ancillary work, but we also started a drywall division in 2004. And so that business has been in process for 11 years, and we've done some major projects in that arena as well. So
almost exclusively on the commercial side.
Almost exclusively commercial, but we are industrial as well. I'm actually a member of the SSPC, which is the trade group for Industrial Painting, Steel Structures Painting Council, and have been a member of the Industrial Painting Committee and its president for about 10, 15 years.
Okay.
My dad was a member of that same group for about 30, but these are a group of individuals that are painting all over the United States and the world. We got a member from Abu Dhabi, we got a member from Australia, but these guys are painting the boats up in Newport News and doing the bridges up in Canada and doing the pipeline up in Yukon. It's a very interesting group. And although we don't do a ton of industrial work, it's very interesting for me to be a part of this group so that I can be exposed to some of the new things that are happening and some of the different ways people are accomplishing their tasks. So,
and so as you've, I mean, first of all, congratulations on being a third generation company. It's the numbers are staggering. That how few companies make it to that status. It's less than vastly less than 1% of the companies formed. But what have been some of the cultural cornerstones or differentiators of the firm that kind of started, I guess, with your grandfather and that exists today?
Well, my grandfather's father was a muralist and did some murals downtown. I guess the company always operated on a very high commercial finish end. Mm-hmm. We've touched pretty much every major institutional structure in Atlanta, including the Capitol building. We did the Ritz-Carlton downtown, was a build. We did a number of different jobs at the Falcon Stadium and the Brave Stadium and a variety of different places.
Can I just continue, because it's such an impressive list? 191 Peachtree, Cathedral of St. Philip, Chastain Park, Georgia Aquarium, the CDC. And it goes on and on. Emory, yeah. Everywhere. There really isn't a significant building in the city that you guys haven't worked on.
It's true, and that's really something that we're very proud of. We finished a job in Nashville, Tennessee, a couple years ago. It wasn't an extremely profitable job, but we're very proud of it. We did the Omni Hotel and the Country Music Hall of Fame renovation there. And it was the largest job at the time for us. It was about $19 million and had 400 men on the job site at one time. As you can imagine, that's difficult to manage. But We were very proud of it, and we got very high accolades from one of our companies we really love doing business with, which is Brassfield and Gorey. Mm-hmm. And so it was a challenge. It was something that I'm in many ways glad we went through, so we would recognize some of the, you know, challenges of a job like that. I did lose a lot of hair during that time, but I've learned to wear hats. Yes.
But you know, as far as the history goes, that client focus and really the attention to detail and excellence as it relates to the delivery, other things that have kind of come up from over the years that are just part of your business.
Yeah, well, you know, it's so much of our business is detail.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, when you're building a building or doing a residence or doing any structure whatsoever, 9 times out of 10, what the architect or the engineer or everyone sees is the finish.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of our kind of motto is that the finish matters, you know, think Goodman.
Right.
And at the end of the day, we have to have a pristine looking finish. And so we may not be the cheapest contractor that you're going to buy out of a job. But I guarantee you on a Goodman job, when you put 55 cents into that Coke machine, you're going to get a Coke.
Right.
And you're going to get a nice finish. And that's what we sort of predicate our company on.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Brassfield and Gorey. There are other, your clients are the actual building. They're oftentimes the contractor in charge in mm-hmm. some instances. And then there are other constituencies involved as well in these major, massive projects. How do you really kind of work to maximize that partnership between all those, I guess, complementary but sometimes competing interests?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're bridge builders. In our history, I don't think we've had a lawsuit where someone hasn't asked us to bring the lawsuit, meaning with sort of a partnering almost sense.
Okay.
There are contractors out there who love to burn bridges, and they're successful doing that.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't operate in that vein, and maybe to a fault sometimes, but we consider relationships and the ability to do repeat work the most important part of our business model. Reasoning why is, think about every job that you do having a new set of people to deal with and how difficult that might be on a continual basis, particularly if you're operating a business that's going to last 87 years and hopefully bridge into the fourth generation.
Right.
So conceptually, we try to, in a very professional manner, take care of our clients, our partners, who we think of as partners,
mm-hmm.
take care of our people, obviously, who we think of as family, and do the best job we can in the most productive, efficient manner and bring our history of expertise to the table to help everyone win.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of our model.
And you mentioned think Goodman because the finish matters. That's kind of your branding tagline or whatever. So you have this incredible history, this reputation in the market. How do you take a very well-established brand like you have and continue to energize it or re-energize it in the market? I would just love your perspective on that.
Well, the way I look at it, I'm 57 years old, and I've been through the time when my dad would say to me, "Jeffrey, you know, you can talk to the 25-year-old engineer or project manager with that company, and he'll be open with you. I try to talk to him. He's going to be nervous. He's not going to say anything to me." And now the roles are reversed.
Mm-hmm.
We have some new people in our company that are in their 20s and early 30s that if I go to a job site, they may be a little inhibited to talk to me, but they'll talk to Adam Diamond, for instance, my nephew who's been in the business 5 or 6 years, or a Mike Head, who's one of our superintendents. He's been in the business for 10, 11 years. And conceptually, the future of our company is predicated on the youth grabbing that coin out of your hand and
right.
saying, "Listen, we're going to run with this thing and we're going to take it this direction." My job now, as I see it, over the next 5 to 10 years, is to try to give these guys the opportunity and to go the direction they want to go in.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, 20 years from now, they've chosen this direction. And we have a great model on the floor. We have a great business that's operating. And it's a good environment for business right now, as you can see around Atlanta with all the cranes up.
Right.
But as far as broadening that scale, maybe geographically, or getting into other lines of work, I need to see that these guys truly want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an opportunity for them. We have a good base operation to do that. The question is how much do you want? And in my experience, certainly we could be doing work all over the country and maybe the world right now, but what would that do to the balance of my life personally?
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend of mine very close that's on the Industrial Painting Committee that's doing the Capitol building up in New York. And we were talking last week, and you know, we're talking about how much is enough.
Right.
And it's consuming his life.
Yeah.
Right now. And he's a very successful guy. But it's a question I think he's asking himself, do I really want this? At the same time, it's something he's in the middle of and has to perform.
Right.
We're meeting up for our next meeting up in Nantucket in October. And I'm telling him, well, hopefully we'll be able to celebrate then, you know, but.
Well, that's a fascinating kind of question, because, you know, so many of our listeners face going from a more local business to a regional business, or a regional business to a national business. You guys sound like you've kind of been primarily Atlanta/Georgia focused, but you will occasionally get pulled into regional jobs. Is that fair? Or
it's absolutely fair. The concept we've always worked on in that arena is that we will travel with the people we know.
Okay.
Yeah. We do not seek out work in areas that we don't know the people or don't know the companies. If a Holder Construction Company wants us to go to Virginia, mm-hmm. or to, you know, Maryland, certainly we're going to consider it, because they've asked us, hey, we need some help.
Right.
You know, but we're certainly not going to do it for XYZ Company, which we don't know the entities for. I mean, we've done work in the Bahamas because we knew the people that were performing the work. Now, it was a new company, but the people within the company we had done business with before, and we knew them, and we knew how they operated. And
I'm sure you guys enjoyed being in the Bahamas for a little bit.
There's a couple of people that enjoyed it. There's many other people that thought it was a big sacrifice.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a job that, you know, we had to have a partner down there that was a 50-50 kind of deal. And there was a lot of very difficult work that we had to pull through.
Hmm.
So that was a good plow down there.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but there is this element of how big is okay big, and then this also this element of life's too short if you really kind of get outside of your core competency or whatever. So,
you know, both of us know what that means, you know, and it's I think that it's that's what's sort of the makes it an interesting field,
mm-hmm.
you know, because one, there are competitive demands in the field. You have to get enough work to survive. You have to get enough work to produce. You have to get enough work to grow. You can't stay static,
right?
As we both know. And at the same time, you want to have the right, you know, amount of eggs in your basket. So every month, every year that we're looking at these things, we're constantly asking ourselves, you know, what is the right fit?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we make great decisions, and sometimes we make decisions and we go, what were we thinking, you know? But I think that is sort of the fun part of life. You know, nobody knows what's coming down the corner, around the corner. And I think that in general, you always want to be in the truck with the guy who knows how to drive.
Yeah.
Right? Right. You don't want to be in the truck with the company that, what are we doing here? And because we are beholden to predecessor trades to a large extent. The guys in front of us don't know what they're doing, or fall behind schedule, or installing the work chaotically. It becomes very, very difficult for us. It's hard for us to make money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're very happy to see many of our, you know, local subcontractors on jobs that we know really well when we get out there, particularly drywall.
It's, you know, the last few years have been difficult from a downturn perspective. You guys have obviously survived and thrived through that, but talk about any lessons learned, you know, in in your career, maybe particularly as it relates to those last few years where, you know, particularly at the general contractor level, you know, volumes in some instances, you know, cut in half or whatever.
People cut in half.
And people and the kind of impact of that.
We were very fortunate with our company not to have to let anyone go. During that cycle, we were able to manage through it. What's kind of unusual about that situation, we came off one of the greatest jobs we've had in our history in 2007 and then found 2008 to be one of the worst, a couple of the worst jobs we ever had in history. So it's one of those things that, you know, obviously a little bit market driven, obviously a little bit, we got ahead of ourselves and said, well, we can repeat this and repeat this again, where in fact we really didn't recognize some of the exigencies that we were going to face on those jobs. And then the market hit. And, you know, I give a credit to everyone in our company because we've had many, many families and generations of families in our company that have continually performed and have been able to help keep Goodman's name bright and shiny and perpetuating. So conceptually, everyone realized that these were difficult times. Everyone understands that there has to be an extra effort made, and everyone has to watch their X's and O's. And we managed through it, you know. To me, there, it was not a tremendous amount of fallout in terms of companies during that time frame. I have had conversations with my risk advisor, and it was interesting, and we thought there would be more companies that really, really got impacted more heavily, and maybe they did on a personal basis, but they were able to survive.
Right.
We came through it okay, and we were excited, actually, about the next 3 or 4 years. It looked like it's going to be a very upmarket again.
Right.
And
so it was real, so part of it was having that team in place that you could really, everybody dug deep together and really kind of continued on.
It's a trust thing.
Right.
And I guess that to some extent that's a differentiator for us as well. If you've been through this many years in business, you know, you have people like Greg Toler in our company who's been a superintendent for us for 20, 25, 30 years. Raymond Allred, who's been a painter in the field that's been with us for 30, 35 years. You know, Matt Terrell, who's a general manager of our company, he's been with us for like 12, 15 years. And these guys are all seasoned. Mm-hmm. They all know their business. They all are very loyal to the firm, and they're treated well. And, you know, ultimately, if I'm in, you know, Zimbabwe, I always ask this question. I said, what would you do? How would you answer this question? Or how would you bid this job? Or how would you deal with this situation if I'm not there to counsel you? Mm-hmm. And I trust their instincts, you know, but that's how we... that's how companies work in the small business arena.
So one of the biggest challenges of, you know, a business owner is finding the time to work on the business, not necessarily in the business. And it sounds like you've really made that transition because you have such an incredible group team involved with you. But, you know, that's a...
It's challenging.
That's a challenge, I guess, for everyone.
And that's a challenge that I'm sort of facing now, where I'm trying to get my arms around, you know, how to mentor as opposed to lead or to be a person that's out there selling. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm watching the books and I'm watching the background of the company's finances and all the different things that a good manager slash owner would do. But my role is getting considerably more in the process of mentoring and how best to do that. And so what I've seen is that, you know, as a family business, which I've continually tell you about our groups of people that have been with us for so many years, and we have a couple of estimators that are sons of one of our key people who have been with us 30 years. Now, they worked in the field. They worked under him in the field, a family affair, and they were intelligent guys. One of them, neither one of them have been to college, but they're smart. And, you know, part of our business is, you know, we've always kind of differentiated ourselves a little bit with too, is we've always been interested in technology. Mm-hmm. We like the new gadgets. We like to see how things work. We like, you know, we were very early on screen takeoffs and different types of audit type measurements and whatnot that we can do with iPads and our tech. And these kids that are growing up today, that's their world.
Right.
You know, my son particularly, you know, is just, he's so far ahead of me technologically. So we stuck them in the office and said, listen, you've been in the field. You've watched these guys apply the paint. You watch these guys do this business. This is doing on-screen and doing work on estimating is just a leap of getting your head around a different way of thinking about things. And so what I've done is I've stuck a couple of guys, these two brothers, offices next to each other, and I have their father sort of mentoring them on the production aspects of estimating. And it's the perfect world in some respects in that they have a tremendous amount of respect for their dad. And he's overseeing them. Hmm. And, of course, my general manager is obviously the one person that's really in charge of them, charge of the estimating and looking at their estimates and making sure the bids are right. But it's a world where there are a good amount of healthy growth and healthy experiences in terms of this is not right, this is right. You know, the things that always go through, everybody's head when they're in a new field and a new job. I mean, I graduated from the University of Georgia, and economics professor said, well, you know, to our students, you know, when we left, he said, you know, go out there and you're going to cause a lot of damage. Just realize that, you know. And I said, okay. And it's true. I mean, when you're green, you don't wittingly want to do it, but you're going to cause damage. You just don't realize it. And the more you're full of yourself and the more you think you've got it handled, there's things that you're not thinking about, you know. Right. So it's a pristine world of estimating in an office, but there's a whole nother world of the working man out in the field and what that working man has to go through. And these kids fortunately know that, so they have a little bit of that taste in their mouth.
Right.
And to make the leap inside is what we're trying to do currently. And I think it makes a lot of sense.
Well, that speaks to the benefits of longevity of employee base and moving, being a pretty porous institution and moving people into different roles and responsibilities as they can kind of move around a little bit. I hadn't really, you know, so much of corporate life, they talk about the nepotism and, you know, staying away from family, you know, families working together. But, you know, and it's interesting that you're not only a family-owned business, but that you have generational connections and ties even within your employee base. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. And it sometimes can be troubling. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, if there's something goes wrong, you know, that trust has got to be implicit. Just like if you were my brother. Mm-hmm. You know, I've known a guy for 30 years, and his son is messing up, and I have to talk to him. And, you know, usually I bring the dad in with me, you know. But the fun thing about this business is the people. And it's pretty much every business.
Right.
Sure. I mean, obviously, there are companies that deal with numbers all the time, and I congratulate guys that can look on the screen and never take their eyes off of it. But in my... You know, if I look at my history with the company and look at my life in my business, my family business, you know, which I have great pride in being third generation. One of the fabulous things about being in there is like, you know, one moment I'll be possibly talking to a guy that, you know, just got off the street, maybe is looking for a job and, you know, maybe just got out of jail. Mm-hmm. And we're considering for a position. And then the next day I might be up in, you know, the president's offices of Atlanta Capital talking to Sonny Dariso.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's an interesting variety of people that are in this business, and that's what gives it color.
Mm-hmm.
And makes it interesting because there's a lot of different perspectives, you know? So
that's fascinating. You mentioned the technology element of this. I have to admit, you know, I don't really, you know, at first I would think that there's elements of your business that are somewhat low tech to a certain extent, but technology must have been fairly transformative over the last decade. You know, how have you incorporate, go into that a little bit more about, you know, how that helps your, I guess, margins, how it helps your estimating, your accuracy on job, everything. It's last week we spoke to Paul Van Slyke, who's been involved at as an architect in the Atlanta Falcons Stadium, and he was just speaking to the fact that, you know, really the planning and the execution of that project is a day-to-day back and forth between the architecture team and the people on site. I guess that's really true for your world as well, and that technology significantly enables that in a different way than was possible while ago.
Well, you know, specifically on a complicated job like the Falcon Stadium, the BIM technology and how things fit together can be easily seen way ahead of when the actual event occurs, so that they can basically avoid problems that they may not have seen on a set of architectural drawings that are 2D.
Yeah.
As far as estimating goes, these kids that are growing up today grew up on video games.
Right.
And now they're touchscreen video games, you know, and it's like coloring up a set of drawings by hand versus doing it with a mouse. It's unbelievable how effective it is for us to be able to first of all, see the audit trail of the drawings being colored up.
Hmm.
That's one thing. So you know it was taken off because you can see it's colored. Two, being able to hand a set of drawings to someone and they'll know the ceiling heights, they'll know the colors on the walls, they'll know. I mean, you can give them information that previously would have taken a long time to develop and now is relatively routine after you finish the takeoff.
Hmm.
And then with the Excel spreadsheets and whatnot that we use, it's we're able to update our production figures much easier, and we don't have the addition errors. You know, obviously it's garbage in, garbage out, but it's shortened the life cycle for that type of work, and in some ways it's great. Mm-hmm. You know, some ways, you know, I caution our guys and say, hey, you know, remember what you're doing here. Take a deep breath. Everything doesn't have to be a 100-yard dash, right? Because this is not a race. This is a rational, you know, work that we're trying to perform to come up with a pricing scenario that we can actually perform and takes into account all the variables that we can possibly put our mind around,
mm-hmm.
not something that we just need to take off a computer, spit out. There's an artistry, even with all the data that we get, as far as how to put it together and to put it together in a way that's going to make sense.
Well, and there's also what's actually happening on site and, you know, the elements of getting the work done. Talk about the safety elements. You probably, you know, I think about some of the open spaces in the buildings that we've discussed, and there's just, how do you manage that safety element of it for your folks and some of the challenges there?
Yeah, safety is, we've actually implemented a safety committee in the last year and a half to promote safety from within more so than just the typical toolbox talks or the typical general contractor-driven safety programs.
Mm-hmm.
Because people preach safety, and they preach it, and they preach it, and they preach it to the point where you don't hear it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like.
So you've said it so much that your guys just don't. It doesn't even connect, or they tune out.
You have to come up with ways of getting people to think about it differently, and you have to have buy-in from the ground floor all the way up to the president.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you do that? You know, we put together a safety committee of people from the field, journeymen, foreman, superintendents, my general manager, and myself. And this is a revolving committee that's going to happen every 6 months. We are in like our seventh, eighth, ninth month of this particular incarnation. And we've had meetings every month. And the concept is to go over and drill down into what's happening in the field, visit the jobs and drill down on what's actually happening there versus what we think is happening there, what we hope is happening. Yeah, because every day we're geared to fill out the safety report, turn in our information, turn in our daily report that shows what activities happened on the day and if anything went wrong. But for and the other side of the coin that we haven't spoken about is a tremendous amount of non-English speaking people mm-hmm. that are on the job sites that require the same type of information systems for safety as English people.
Right.
So, I mean, so we have sometimes have to have translators on the job and translated data material and making sure that they understand what we're trying to incorporate. So it's a challenge. But at the same time, rather than leaving it up to, you know, our safety director and our safety director's assistant to just implement on every single job, we thought that it would be more important and longer range, good for the industry, for our contractor that we're doing business for the owner that we do business for, to actually come up with something on our own that hopefully will inspire people to think and to watch and look around where they're working, because half the time safety accidents can be avoided by just saying something mm-hmm. or being conscious of your environment. And everyone on the job site should be responsible for that. It's not the GC's responsibility alone. It's the subcontractors. It's the architect. Everyone in that field should be looking around and saying, wait a minute, that cord is frayed, or that ladder is not put up correctly, or that scaffolding shouldn't be done that way. Mm-hmm. You know, and if everyone was conscious of that 24/7, it'd be a little bit safer.
Right.
Now, people are still going to trip on stairs. And I just cannot, you know, fathom, you know, how we analyze that risk. And I'm sure there's somebody that could come up with a calculus for that.
Right.
But those are things that are somewhat unavoidable. Mm-hmm. But the avoidable things, particularly the things that are, you know, that can cost someone's life, it is paramount for subs to be on board with the stuff and to be proactive.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. You've been obviously been critically involved in the city of Atlanta for a long time. You mentioned that things are definitely getting better from a business standpoint. Maybe pull back a little bit and just, I love your view on the future of our city and what you see, you know, coming in the next 10, 20 years.
You know, I've been here my whole life. I mean, I went to school in California and went to school up in Boston and came back to Atlanta and graduated from the University of Georgia. And it's been a tremendous renaissance in some ways of the city in terms of what it looks like then, what it looks like today. And 20 years from now or 10, 20 years from now, if you're looking down the road like that, particularly with these two new stadiums going up and the infrastructure going in downtown with Georgia Tech, and the infrastructure going downtown, deep downtown with Georgia State,
mm-hmm.
We're becoming more and more of a cosmopolitan city on the, you know, the likes of New York and some places that have integrated those types of schools within the city, and they branch off and they, you know, the ancillary things that happen as a result of that is amazing. You know, people want to be a part of it. People want to be in a thriving, colorful, cultural place. I still personally believe that artistically and culturally we're still lagging mm-hmm. in those arenas. And I think, and I'm hopeful that the demands of the people that are moving in and all these condominiums you see going up are going to demand those types of environments. They're going to demand the Shakespeare, you know, a place to go see Shakespeare. They're going to demand, you know, the galleries and the music venues and the art venues. And so I'm hopeful in the next 20 years that our city makes that leap of and begins to be vital in that arena as well.
So in the same way that we've become very good at building buildings and building homes and neighborhoods, to really kind of continue to expand that from a cultural standpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would agree. It's there's definitely opportunity there, but there's a lot of incredible institutions that exist that, you know, kind of create a framework for that as
Absolutely,
well,
yeah.
which is great. Every week I ask each guest what the best business advice they've ever received is.
Okay.
Thoughts
well,
on
I
that?
Got a good one.
Okay.
I think. And it came in early in my career. And it's I think it's really important for young people to know, but maybe older people as well. I mean, there's this real estate agent that sold us one of the first buildings we bought. And I was telling him about my music and, you know, about Goodman. And I just was in my early 20s. And he said, you know, you can't have two masters. And I thought about it. And I said, oh, my God, you know, that's some sage advice, because it's always in some ways tormented me a little bit my whole career, in that, you know, I would love to be able to play music on the side and be able to perform and write songs, which I do. Mm-hmm. But I don't do it to the near the extent that probably I need to do to become, I guess, better at my craft.
Okay.
I spend a tremendous amount of time at work. I spend a lot of time thinking about work. And I use music as a way, as an avocation for myself to sort of blend in some creativity into my life. But that was some sage advice, and I took it to heart and devoted, you know, most of my last 30 years or so to Goodman and to its, you know, to its success.
But you've maintained your love and passion of music, and also had some interesting mm-hmm. side projects on that front. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so I've always written music. I've been playing piano since I was 6 years old. I'm currently the pianist for the Rotary Club of Atlanta.
Oh, really?
Downtown okay. Rotary Club, and
where you've been involved for years.
Been
right?
involved for years and. Mm-hmm. It's a great club. It's 480 members, diverse decision makers from many, many, many different companies. It's just it's a fantastic club to be a part of. I guess in the last 15 years, I decided to do a little bit more production and a little bit more work on my music. I've recorded a couple albums in the last 15 years. I did an album called Turnip in 2001 that got played on a lot of college radio. And then last year I recorded another album under the moniker Moondy, Moondy, an album called Puffers, which got played on about 150 college radio stations and produced a video that got about 10,000 airplay on YouTube.
Wow. All right.
Called Boo. And it's sort of a fun video. I got it done by a Japanese guy that I'd never met, but went on a site in Britain that was you put up a certain amount of money and they would produce it for you. In this case, he did a fantastic job, and it's sort of a Halloween type video that I think hopefully will be evergreen. Every time Halloween rolls around, people want to watch this video. So
that's great.
Anyway,
so you still find time to even though it's, you know, you're focusing on that primary thing, it's important to have hobbies, interests, something that kind of offset yeah. the and kind of connect the creative processes between your professional career and your other professional career.
I think what, you know, the concept of two masters I completely agree with, yeah. particularly as a young person starting out. Mm-hmm. But then as you get older and you learn that balance is also very, very important.
Right.
Between family and work and avocations and leisure. And I've always thought that, you know, being in a family business, family is sort of become paramount in your life. Your brothers, your sisters that you work with, your son, your wife, and you want to do good by all these people. And at the same time, you have ambitions yourself, mm-hmm. right? Everybody has hopefully a dream and hopefully ambitions. And my dream, for instance, outside of Goodman, has been writing a song that will be remembered by everyone for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I'm not, you know, completely ignorant of the fact that we are all going to be dust eventually.
Right.
Very soon. And that at the end of life, that, you know, we're not going to probably be remembered for very long, but if the goals that you have in your lifetime, I think, are meaningful, and I think that, you know, helping people and trying to preserve, make the world a better place is a is a, obviously a tremendous aspiration. And trying to write something that people will remember is a great aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you look at Shakespeare, that's people read Shakespeare, and he's been around 400 or 500 years now. And I think you think about the Beatles, and they may not have the longevity of Shakespeare. They might.
Yeah.
You know, these are things that are really, they bring treasure, and they bring wisdom, and they bring love, and they bring, you know, insight to so many people for eons almost now. And that is a good thing to do, because essentially what you're saying is that you can put your hand out when you're gone to somebody's shoulder and say, hey, look at this, and maybe touch somebody's life and have your life kind of still in some way be a part of someone else's life maybe 100 years from now. So
on this whole topic of creativity and innovation, whether it's professional or you know, and what you're describing around the music and songwriting, how does that happen for you? What's the, or do you find that there are environments where that, where that's better for you, or
it's a great,
you know,
question.
How do you kind of get into that mindset? Because you know, that aha moment happens for entrepreneurs all the time, and sometimes it's at the beginning of a business, sometimes it's mid stage, or you know, something that you're grappling with, sometimes it's from a hobby or an interest. I just love your perspective on that.
The great thing about having something like this in my life to be able to do, and I thank my parents for letting me have piano lessons when I was 6, and my grandfather for buying me a baby grand piano when I was 13. I mean, I can never, ever thank them enough for that. But the great thing is this. You work 10, 11 hours a day, and in sometimes very stressful environments. And sometimes, and lately, coming home at 57 years old, you're about ready to, you know, get in the shower and go to bed. But when I do have the energy, it is such a completely different arena.
Mm-hmm.
That it allows me to sort of tranche down or unwind what's been happening.
Yeah.
And it's become a little bit like a foil in a way for me to be able to kind of, you know, listen to music or play music and to be able to do something, you know, that's completely fresh compared to what I've been doing. My son and I were just in Wyoming. We saw the most beautiful places in, I think, in the United States at Grand Tetons and Yellowstone. I tell everyone that they should take their son or daughter and they should go there post haste.
Right.
But didn't play any piano during the whole week and came home and just, it felt fresh. It felt wonderful. These are the times that, you know, the creativity comes out. That and driving. For some reason, driving is a hypnotic thing that allows kind of your brain somehow to work in a little bit more creative fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that answers your question.
No, that's helpful. Yeah. It's it always seems like it's the down moments or when you are making that shift to something else that there, it's either in doing it or in the transition that there's a click sometimes.
And sometimes obviously, I mean, creativity in business or in life comes in so many different realms. You've got to be open to it.
Right.
You know, one of the questions you told me you might want to ask was what books were influential to me.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And, you know, early in my career, Seven Habits was one of the greatest books.
Right.
I mean,
Stephen Covey.
Yeah, that's just a classic.
Right.
But one book that many people might not know about is the Artist's Way.
Hmm.
It was written by Julia Cameron, and it's really geared towards being a writer, but it's great for anyone trying to open up the creative center. And it's, the concept of the book is predicated on basically three activities that you do on a regular basis. One is you wake up in the morning and you write pretty much stream of consciously a page or two of what's called the morning pages. And it's just kind of filtering out your mind of everything that's going on and trying to get on paper what it is you're thinking about or anything that comes into your head. And it's amazing how that works. It kind of cleanses yourself. The other activity is taking a walk on a daily basis, if you can find the time to do it and let your mind just sort of ease into the walking and let your mind go. Mm-hmm. And think in terms of creative, of different creative ways. The last activity she has in the book is called the artist date, which is an interesting concept of finding some place one time a week where you're taking yourself away from your business, taking yourself away from your normal whirlwind that we talked about.
Right.
And going maybe to a button store and looking through the buttons and thinking, what can I do with this? Or going to a museum and looking at the art, or taking yourself to a jazz club, mm-hmm. or taking yourself to someplace that, is completely foreign to what you're doing, and letting your mind reactivate and create a different kind of center for yourself. So I've gotten great mileage out of that book in the last really 15, 20 years, and some of the subsequent books she's written. She's written 2 or 3 follow-ups to it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, those are the 2 books.
Thank you for sharing that, because that's... we all are oftentimes looking for inspiration in different places, and sometimes it's the mundane or something that we make time for on a regular basis that's what creates the vigor or the reflection, and then sometimes the reactivation. That's fascinating. Jeffrey, thank you for being with us this morning. This has been really great to get your perspective on so many things. Tell our listeners how they can learn more about Goodman.
Okay. Well, thanks to you, John. I appreciate it as well. You can contact us at www.thinkgoodman.com or call me at my office at 404-965-2537. Or you can email me at jmd@thinkgoodman.com.
Really appreciate your being with us, Jeffrey. This has been fantastic. And join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.